listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 35. Hello and welcome to today's show. Today's show is all about fidget spinners and sensory processing disorder. So sensory processing disorder is a serious condition that children with special educational needs such as Asperger's syndrome and autism often suffer from, and it causes them to fidget, and that's the connection with fidget spinners. So we've got a fantastic interview today with Becky Liddon, who's going to explain to us what exactly sensory processing disorder is, the connection with fidget spinners, and everything you need to know about it. But first, I just wanted to say it's a really important day for me today because it's my book's first birthday. So my book, The 10-Step Guide to Acing Every Exam You Ever Take, was published on the 14th of February last year. And so today it is 1 year old. It's been an absolutely amazing year for me, and the book, along with various other things, have really kind of catapulted the fortunes of me and my business forward. The book was featured in the Daily Telegraph just a few weeks before it was published, and that really boosted sales, and I've had nothing but positive feedback about the book ever since. It's got 100% five-star reviews on Amazon, and people are getting in touch with me all the time to say how much it's impacted their lives and how much it has helped them. So today's a really special day. If you don't already have a copy of the book, you can find it on Amazon. It's called The 10-Step Guide to Acing Every Exam You Ever Take. And there's a link in the show notes for you to be able to find the book. And there's also a tab at the top of my website, which will take you straight to the book. At the time of the recording, Amazon have the book on special offer. So usually it's £12, but the day I'm recording this, it's on sale for £9.34. So snap it up while you can, while the price is good. Okay, let's go over to today's fantastic interview with Becky Liddon. Born and raised in Devon, our guest today founded Sensory Spectacle in 2014. Originally from the field of graphic design, she was captivated by the autistic sensory world whilst working in a centre in West London that supports children and young people with complex health needs and disabilities. Throughout the 7 years she worked there, she set up a sensory toy library, qualified as a regional Makaton tutor, and trained the staff to support sensory needs of the children. Alongside her work, she completed her master's degree in art and science from Central St Martin's, University of the Arts, London, receiving a distinction for her installations focusing on the autistic sensory world. Her experience and understanding of sensory processing difficulties, SPD, inspired her to educate the public on how people with SPD may experience their surroundings, and thus Sensory Spectacle was born. Sensory Spectacle creates experiential installations to help educate about SPD. Our guest designs and builds environments to help society experience for themselves how SPD can impact their daily lives. She created the Sensory Classroom in 2015 and launched the Sensory Dining Room in early 2016 to teach, through experience, about SPD. By learning through the experience of her installations, she creates awareness and encourages parents and professionals to empathise. Her installations have been known to change the way adults and children with additional needs are cared for by parents and professionals. Sensory Spectacle provides installations for awareness at events, runs workshops to educate and support teams and organisations, presents at conferences and organises awareness events throughout the year to educate the public and support families and people with SPD. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Becky Liddon.
Hello, nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So Becky, first of all, could you explain to me and the audience exactly what sensory processing or disorder or SPD actually is?
Yes, I think that's a good place to start. So sensory processing disorder is when our brain finds it difficult to do its most important job, which is that of organising the information it receives. So when we meander through our environment, our senses are constantly receiving information about it. So our senses will receive those messages and send them to our brain, but our brain might find it difficult to modulate all those sensations and tell us which is the important sensation at that moment in time. So, for example, someone may be in a classroom, for example, and they might be hearing all of the sounds almost described to be at the same volume. So things like someone writing on their paper, someone swinging back on their chair, maybe someone in the other room walking out of the door, down the corridor, the lights buzzing, the radiators humming. So the sounds that we might naturally be able to filter out or maybe ignore in our environment, some people are tuning into those sounds, which can then mean that it becomes quite overwhelming for them to identify what's important and what's not at that moment in time. Some people can also be the opposite and be understimulated, so you might recognise them seeking out sensations. So things like rocking back on our chairs, sometimes we're doing that to give ourselves more vestibular, more sensations of movement to help us to be able to then regulate and focus what we're doing within that, in that environment.
Okay, so with somebody with SPD, can they, all their senses at the kind of most external level on their body, like their touch, their smell, their taste, all those things work, it's just how it's processed in the brain that doesn't work as it should, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So all of the organs work perfectly fine. It's just the organisation of the messages.
It must be terribly confusing. I know my dad, who's 90, he's got hearing aids and he complains about all the noises the children make. He couldn't hear before. It must be a bit like that for the people you're describing. And I've heard of people being kind of, I can't remember what the word is, but like like hypersensitive stimulation. Yep. Is that basically the same kind of thing?
Yeah, so with a sensory processing disorder, there's kind of three main ways that it could impact you. You could have difficulties with modulating information. So that might be where someone's hypersensitive. So the example where I was talking about the sounds in the room, they're hearing all of those sounds at the same volume. So it's like they're receiving too much information. They could be hypo, so not receiving enough, which was where I said we might seek for it. So we might rock back on our chair to give ourselves more stimulation. Some people might have difficulties with discriminating information, and what that relates to is being able to identify where that sensation's come from. So if we're thinking about sound again, if someone was to call my name, I might find it a little bit more difficult to identify the location of where that sound came from. So if it was the teacher at the front of the class, I might not necessarily respond to their voice immediately because the processing might take a bit longer to identify that it's them. And that can happen to any sensory system. So it might be someone touched their hand. Maybe it took them a little bit longer to identify that it was on their hand that they felt that sensation.
Okay, so what kind of people have sensory processing disorder? Is it in the general population or are there specific groups of people that suffer from it?
It can impact anyone. So they say research from the Star Institute in America, 1 in 20 of the general population are impacted by sensory processing disorder. However, it's highly linked to people on the autistic spectrum. So research there says over 75%. I work a lot with autistic people and they would say that actually it impacts everybody. So you can imagine how much of a high number of population that is. But it can also impact...
So that's every autistic person, you're saying, not everybody in the whole world.
Every autistic person. Yeah, that's what autistic people feel. And actually maybe it's part of the autism. But also it can impact many other diagnoses as well. So people maybe with ADHD or physical disabilities, communication difficulties. So it's not just people with special needs, it can impact the general public as well.
Okay. So what are the signs that your child might have SPD? How can you begin to think that maybe you should be seeking a diagnosis?
So some of the first ways that you would identify it would be looking at the modulation difficulties. They tend to be the ones that are most recognisable. So it might be if someone's hypersensitive to sound, you might see that they cover their ears, or maybe they don't like to be in noisy, unpredictable environments. Mm-hmm. It might be that, again, in crowdy situations, not being able to walk through supermarkets when they're really busy, so that might be tactile defensiveness. So you would identify it through characteristics within their kind of everyday behaviour. If someone's seeking some sensations, it might be, so say if they're seeking visual information, you might notice that maybe they are on their phones a lot, or they're reading lots of books. So when we read a book, we get lots of visual information, whether it's from the words or from the letters. Mm-hmm. High contrasting pictures as well.
If you've got a particularly bookish teenager, could that be a sign, or is there anything else that might be that might go alongside lots of reading? So
a sensory processing disorder is when it will impact their ability then to focus on everyday tasks or what they're being asked to do. So if they're just a teenager reading their book, engrossed in their book, mm-hmm. there's no identification of a sensory processing difficulty. If they're absorbed into their book, but maybe they find it very difficult then to be able to focus on other things that are happening within their environment, mm-hmm. Because they're so absorbed into that, seeking, needing that visual stimulation to be able to focus, mm-hmm. That's where I might then start to look at other parts of their day. So it might be that bright lights are painful, so transitioning from inside to outside might seem that someone's got their hood up all the time. That can be again another sign of reducing the visual information in their environment, which are also quite common characteristics for lots of teenagers.
Okay, that's really interesting. I don't know whether to say this or not, but I find that, like, if I'm doing a task, I'm often very, very absorbed in it. I'm concentrating and very intensely on it, and other people find it hard to distract me from it. Could that be a sign?
It would depend how much you find it difficult to focus on another task. Obviously, if you're passionate about something, you are going to be totally absorbed within it. If you think about when people study, some people can need a radio playing, and some people really can't concentrate mm-hmm. with the radio playing. That's to begin with, that's when we think about sensory preferences. So that's things that we like. But it gets to a point where actually, if the radio isn't playing, I actually need that auditory input mm-hmm. to be able to write. So if I'm finding it very difficult to work in class because there's no other auditory information going on around me, mm-hmm. you might find that I'm the one making the sounds or constantly having conversations with my friends to yeah. try and create that stimulation. So then I'm able to, something called sensory integration, so that all my senses can all work together, so that I'm able to focus.
So that would really be a problem in exams.
Yes.
It's a background noise to be able to concentrate. Yeah, interesting. So how does SPD affect children's learning or teenagers' learning?
So, like I said, it will impact their ability to be able to focus. So if someone's seeking sound, they will need that extra auditory input to be able to regulate themselves. How I describe it is, if you imagine a horizontal line, that in the middle of that picture, you've got the horizontal line, that's us. We're able to regulate our sensory information throughout our day, whether we walk past a horrible smell, we're able to kind of modulate that out quite quickly to be mm-hmm. able to kind of stay quite steady. Yeah. If someone's above that line and they're receiving a lot of stimulation, they'll need to be doing something to try and bring themselves back down to that midline. Mm-hmm. So that's where you might see someone covering their ears or pulling their hood up or squinting their eyes, or refusing to wear certain clothing. That's when they're trying to control that for themselves to be able to regulate their input. If they find it difficult to regulate that sensory input, then it's likely they will find it very difficult to concentrate on simple things like being able to answer questions in a exam, like you just said.
Yeah, I remember one boy I used to teach, I think he was in year 7 at the time, and he had Asperger's syndrome, and he just would never, he would rock backwards and forwards on his chair all lesson, and he would not write anything at all lesson. And that sounds like, you know, he had SPD from what you're describing.
Yes, I would say it's very common with people who are high functioning to be able to almost cope with it. Mm-hmm. So, yes, by rocking on his chair, he's found his own way of regulating. He might not be practically doing the work, but it doesn't mean he hasn't taken in that information.
Yeah.
So I guess that's where the difficulty lies within education, is trying to be able to encourage them to communicate their knowledge in an appropriate way.
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing to me, it sounds like it's a nightmare for these children that have got SPD if you have like a test in silence, or you know, you've got someone rocking in on a chair and you insist that they stop. And from a teacher's point of view, it's like, how do you maintain order in the classroom with all these things going on? It just sounds like a really, really difficult kind of compromise to reach in the mainstream setting anyway.
Yeah, that's one of the most common things I'm asked when I do workshops with teachers is so fidgets are great. So having something in your hand, it's probably likely when you were at school that you might have chewed on the end of your pen, or you might have twiddled it, or maybe girls twiddling with their hair with a piece of clothing. And when you do that, you're stimulating so many of your senses in different ways. It's almost when we might be nervous or when we might be anxious about something, that's a natural thing that we will do. We want to be aware of our bodies and almost keep ourselves alert. Mm-hmm. Teachers, as part of my workshop, I show them how to make stress balls and things that might be supportive within the classroom. And teachers will ask, but won't it distract everybody else? It won't distract the other students as long as they all have their own way of being able to focus on what they're asked to do. So if everybody needs a fidget or a stress ball or something to be able to concentrate, then they should be able to have access to that, and it won't disrupt the classroom. But I do totally empathise with teachers when they have such big classes.
Wait, to be that able to meet everybody's needs. That one's flicking his pen, that one's swinging on his chair, that one's got a stress ball.
Exactly.
Oh my goodness.
I know. And then if you think about students that need sound, which is really common, but we might just recognise it as someone who talks a lot.
Yeah,
exactly. And if they're needing that sound, obviously that is going to be quite disruptive to the other students who might need to focus in other ways.
That's really interesting. I just want to bring in there, because you've mentioned all these kind of fidget kind of accessories, fidget spinners, because they're so topical at the moment, like they're all the rage. My 5-year-old is delighted to have a Spider-Man fidget spinner for his birthday. What do you think about them?
So it's like these fidget cubes as well. Fidget cubes I kind of understand a bit more, as in each side of the cube has a different kind of button or something to fidget with. Mm-hmm. And it's handheld, so it can go in your pocket really nicely. And also, if need be, you can have it in your pocket and still fidget with it. Fidget spinners are a very different sensation. So it's more about your body awareness, your proprioceptive sense with the balancing of it, but also with the spinning, you're getting that visual sensation as well. Mm-hmm. So I don't have anything negative to say about fidget spinners, as long as they're being used in classes in an appropriate way. And obviously not impacting on other people's learning. If it's a toy, which I feel in some schools it is seen as being a toy, then I understand why you wouldn't want all of your students to have them. But I know many students, especially students with ADHD, where they just seek that kind of fidgeting sensation, and especially if they're visual seekers, by having something quite small and they can hold it within in their hands, they can just gain that sensation to then be able to regulate themselves while they're learning or while they're concentrating.
So as a parent or a teacher, how do you know if your child really needs a fidget spinner or any of these other things that you've been talking about, and how do you know which one is the right one for your child?
You will know because they will find it very difficult to focus on the task that they're being asked to do. So whether it's just that you've asked them to go to the cupboard and get their plate out for dinner or set the table or something, if they find it difficult to be able to process those instructions and become distracted with other things, so maybe if they do jump or spin or cover their ears or seek visuals on their phone or whatever, then that's when I would probably start to try and be aware of it. In class, it might be things like we've already been talking about, so becoming distracted quite easily with other things happening in the classroom. So that's where, so if someone's a seeker, that can be very very difficult to be able to regulate because they need the sensation to be able to concentrate. In terms of knowing what's appropriate for them, so there's some resources which are particularly good and what I suggest kind of in education settings. So there are fidgets and things like that, which, and I think if you can have them available on desks, then that's great. Vibrating cushions are really, really beneficial. So they're especially good for students that find it difficult to sit down for a long period of time.
Okay.
So you're receiving that vestibular input, so the kind of receiving movement, but also the awareness of your body while you're sitting down, which reduces the rocking or the moving, fidgeting around on their seat.
Yeah.
Just things like you can get at the moment, those camping torches that clip onto things. If someone seeks visual information, you can quite easily clip those onto tables and direct that towards the work that they're doing, which will be able to then provide extra visual stimulation for them.
Yeah, so what is actually happening in the brain? Like, because all this stuff, to me, sounds horribly distracting. Totally overwhelm me if I had a fidget spinner and I was trying to concentrate on something and write about it and all that other stuff going on. Like, I need to be totally focused. What are all these kind of fidgets doing in the brain to kind of enable a child to do the work or learn?
I mentioned earlier a term called sensory integration. So that's our senses constantly, every second of every day, are working together. And they're working together to help us to be able to focus and attend, learn. If our senses, if you imagine them as a solid block, all of the senses, if some of those senses might have little chips or niggles out of them, i.e. where we're seeking sound or maybe we're overwhelmed by sound, you can see that if that solid base block isn't solid and it's got chips out of it, how my brain, that's where my brain, the sensations it's receiving might be being missed or might be being misinterpreted and travelling, or not necessarily travelling, but just not being understood, which can then mean when we're coming back to being able to focus, it can be very difficult because I might get distracted by sounds or I might need sound. And so that base has to be solid for us to be able to regulate ourselves. If I ask you to think about your big toe on your right foot.
Yeah.
Is it there?
Yeah, thinking about
give it a wiggle.
Yeah.
So until that moment in time, you probably weren't really receiving many sensations from your big toe.
None at
right?
all. I
you
was
don't
not
need
thinking
to.
About any of my toes at that point.
Yeah. No, exactly. Unless maybe I asked you to stand up and walk around, then you'd receive sensations from your toes.
But you wouldn't really consciously be thinking about them, would you?
No, exactly. But your senses are still receiving those messages. And so by me making you aware of your toe, that's when you start to receive those messages. So throughout your day, your brain is helping you to notice the sensory information that it feels is important. If you're becoming distracted with other sensations or other sounds that are happening or other visual stimulus that's happening, you can see that the ability of all your senses to be able to work together can be impacted. Therefore, your ability to concentrate can be impacted, your ability to focus and to learn, which is ultimately what sensory integration is.
Like if you're seeking extra sound or extra visual stimulus, you're basically trying to make up that foundation, like that basic sensory foundation.
Yeah, you're trying to fill in those gaps that might have been missing.
Yeah, and so then you've got a solid base on which to kind of view the world from.
There's something called the pyramid of learning, which is what I talk about in quite a lot of my workshops, and that's why I'm in my head I'm talking about this base, because the base of that pyramid is our senses. And if we haven't got that solid base, the top of this pyramid is academic learning. So you can see as you travel up this pyramid how that can impact very like stages of our development. So things like the awareness of two sides of our body, hand-eye coordination skills, and then further and further up.
Yeah, and to the more abstract ideas of academic learning.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Thank you for that. Okay, how can an understanding of your child's SBD help to support their learning? So from a parent's point of view, what can they do to understand their particular child's, because it sounds like SBD is a very individual experience. So what can the parent do to really understand their child's precise needs to support particularly their learning in school?
I guess this is where it's most difficult, because sensory processing is a personalized system. How I process my sensory information is very different to how you do. But from a parent's perspective, the best thing you can do is to try and put yourself into their situation. So if identify the characteristics. So if you recognize them rocking back on their chair, try and work out, well, what are they getting from doing that activity? If you're not sure, then do it yourself. And when you're doing it yourself, you can then feel, oh, actually, maybe it's the movement, or maybe it's the visual. So maybe it's the way that the picture changes, if you know that they're a visual learner. Once you've then kind of got that perspective of why they might seek or avoid certain sensations, you'll then be able to help to find resources which you know are going to meet their needs. Parents are the best people, obviously, to support their children because they know them the best. So they're already a million steps ahead of any occupational therapist that might come along and help to support them.
Yeah, so is it for most children with SBD, do they have enough kind of self-awareness to, for if the parent says, you know, does this help, like say swinging on a chair, or does this help, like, I don't know, covering your eyes with sunglasses when you go outside because if the sun's too much for them, you know, do the children have enough self-awareness to be able to communicate what's good and what's bad, or do you just have to deduce that from their behaviours?
Some people will be totally able to regulate themselves, and yes, they might be able to tell you, oh, that's really bright light, actually, I'm going to put on my glasses or whatever. But as like any other spectrum, you will probably have people that might not even recognise that actually that's impacting their ability to learn. So maybe if they do get distracted easily with the sounds around them, they might just think that they get distracted easily rather than identifying it specifically sounds. So that's, I think, where parents can be most supportive, is actually helping teenagers and young people to be able to recognise for themselves their own sensory needs, because they've seen them grow up and they know how they've been in different situations in the past.
Yeah, so by having those conversations with their children, they make their children more aware of what works and what doesn't.
Exactly, and I think that's the most effective way of doing it, because a lot of young people won't want any maybe additional support, because maybe they feel like they can regulate it for themselves, which is amazing. But obviously we want to be able to help, to put in other strategies to support that, so that then they don't feel like they have to regulate it for themselves.
So what other strategies are you thinking of there? Is that things in conjunction with the school or...?
Yeah, so in school settings, like I mentioned, there's lots of things that you can bring in. So like I said about the cushion, it might just be sitting there with some headphones in. It's not necessarily listening to music. It might just help them to block out some of the sounds. A lot of adults that I support actually use the wax that swimmers wear to stop water going in their ears, because it's not obvious. And I think a lot of the time, as we get to young people, they don't want anything obvious to seem like they're different. And so it's about, like, and the little clippy lights that I mentioned, that's something that actually classrooms might have available anyway, maybe desk torches or lamps and things. So I guess it's about discussing with them themselves what might they find easier to concentrate with. Is there something at home that maybe they could then take into school as well, or college? So maybe if they find the lighting difficult, maybe at home they have a lamp on their desk, which they know really helps them to focus.
Okay, and so clearly once families understand the condition as it affects their child fully, they need to talk to schools and have a relationship with schools.
Yeah, and a lot of the time some teachers might find it difficult to understand exactly what it is. There's not that much awareness generally of sensory processing disorder, let alone in kind of mainstream schools. So it's about explaining to them that it's not just something that they do, or it's not just something that they're doing to maybe fidget to be annoying or whatever. It's actually a function that they're doing to help themselves to learn and to concentrate. So it's imperative that the teacher's aware of why they're doing that as well.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, I taught in classrooms for 4 years and I'd never heard of this condition. And, you know, I'm sure that there were some of the children that I, you know, stern words with were probably suffering from this condition, and it's not really fair on them if it's not something that they can control, or, you know, it is a condition that they are controlling by doing that particular behaviour.
You know, so if there was another student that didn't necessarily recognise they have sensory processing difficulties, there's no reason why they couldn't use that to support their learning as well.
Yeah.
So rather than it being, oh no, Bob can have the stress ball today because he really needs it, Paul can just wait, it's actually just making sure that the whole environment is can have access to the support that they need.
Yeah. Okay, so I know that all your arty background that I talked about at the beginning, it sounds fascinating. And I know you create installations to help people to understand what it's actually like to have SPD. So can you describe what your installations are actually like, and how they can possibly kind of give, like, did you call it neurotypical?
Sorry.
Neurotypical people. Wow. I hate to use the word, but normal people. How can they possibly begin to empathise with people with SPD?
I started to create these installations because, like you mentioned as well, I used to support young people with complex health needs, and I used to take them on holiday a lot. And it would be when we were on holiday that members of the public would come and ask me why a child was doing something, whether it was covering their ears and screaming or flickering something in front of their eyes. Or they would ask if they could just stop, if I could stop them from doing what they were doing. And so I just wanted to create something where I could try and give the general public a glimpse into the fact that not everyone perceives their surroundings in the same way. So all of my installations are based on descriptions from people with sensory processing difficulties. So I have an installation called Being Ben, and it's based on a hyper auditory processing difficulty. So where I mentioned earlier, someone described that all the sounds seem to get muddled in their head, or that everything seems at full volume all the time.
Yeah.
And so it's a Perspex cube. You pop your head inside. When your head's inside the cube, you're hearing the sounds from the whole environment heightened. So you're not only hearing your own voice when you're speaking, because obviously it's inside the cube, you're also hearing the lights buzzing or the cars outside driving past or the birds or other people talking within the room. And so when you're hearing your surroundings like that, you can then empathize, understand a little bit quicker in a more relevant way to who you support, whether it's your child or someone in class, how they might find it so distracting to be in certain environments, especially environments where there's lots of technology, because technology creates lots of frequencies and we hear through frequencies, which means that they will then be processing all of those sounds.
Oh, crikey, so all the white noise that on from the radio or from computers and everything.
Yes.
That must be just overwhelming.
Yes, incredibly. So, and that's one of the most common processing difficulties from descriptions, from what people are able to talk about. Other difficulties, I've got a mirrored installation called Lola's World, and that's based on Temple Grandin, who's an autistic American lady. She relates it to Oliver Sacks's breakdown of a migraine. Right. So if that last stage of a migraine is where our vision becomes fragmented and distorted and you can't quite determine depth. So when you're looking in front of the mirror, you can't quite piece yourself together as you might normally see it. Therefore, you might find yourself moving around, maybe moving your head around to try and make that picture whole. And that's, again, a characteristic that you might recognise with someone who has a hypervisual processing difficulty. So they're receiving lots of visual information, but their brain just can't quite order it into that one frame or that one picture. And then I also make kind of whole environments. So I've got one called the sensory classroom. And that's where I will have students enter a classroom. So what, 30 students, members of the public, whoever, parents. And there's a teacher. The teacher asks them to do some work. But while they're in the classroom, they are also exposed to this hyper auditory processing difficulty, hyper visual processing difficulty, and a hyper smell processing difficulty. Because in education, there's lots of smells that go around within the rooms, but also just things like if they're doing PE, where they eat lunch, it's not the most pleasant of experiences. And so, therefore, because you've been asked to do work from the teacher, you then feel that pressure to complete that work. But because you're being distracted with whether it's the sound or the visuals or the smell, by the time you then leave the classroom experience, you've then gained that feeling for yourself of how it might be to put that much pressure on yourself to complete work.
It sounds horrendous, absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, it can be some children, well, and young people can get very anxious about going to school just because of the amount that they have to focus, to be able to regulate themselves all day. And sometimes it means that when those young people get home, they let everything out. So whether they just go and hide in their room for the rest of the evening just to try and relax and get over the stress of regulating themselves all day, or whether they just have a really bad evening at home because they're so tired and stressed.
It's mind-blowing, really, what it must be like to live like that all day, every day.
And it can fluctuate, so it might be that maybe at times of high anxiety, so things like exam time, that can impact them even more. Because if you think, even when we're anxious, we tend to revert to our senses to calm us down. And so that's exactly the same. So it's even more important that during exam times, you have things available to be able to support differently.
It's very interesting. Have you ever heard of children with SPD being given like a different room to do exams in or anything like that, just so that they can have their, that, you know, whatever stimulation that they need?
Definitely schools that are able to accommodate that, very supportive. Even if, so if you think of visual processing difficulty, lots of exams are relying on reading, or maybe like maths, drawing, graphs and things. That can be incredibly overstimulating, especially if someone's anxious. So I have known people to have someone in the room where they're able to verbally explain what's happened to kind of take away the pressure of reading the question as well as having to answer the question visually.
Wow, yeah. So there is help out there. Is it just particular schools that are particularly sensitive to this? Or, you know, if you know your child is struggling, will, you know, you just go to the school and you talk to them about it and see what can be done? Is that, would that be your advice?
Yeah, what I'd suggest is go into school, and if you've been able to have a chat with your child as well about it, young person, then obviously that's even better. Go into school, have a chat with a teacher or someone within their class, and just talk about whether they've noticed any struggles or difficulties, and then try and maybe put some strategies in place together between you. The only other person that can really support would be an occupational therapist.
Okay.
And they would access them
through the NHS.
Yeah, sometimes teacher referrals can help. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's not many on the NHS. So sensory integration trained occupational therapists are the only occupational therapists that can diagnose SPD. Mm-hmm. But a teacher would easily be able to contact an OT. There's one connected with most boroughs.
Okay.
So they would be able to at least email them and say, look, I've got this young person that needs extra support with visually integrating or whatever. They should be able to give you some strategies. If not, then I'm more than happy to help teachers know how to support their students if they need help. And I've got lots of free videos on YouTube as well.
We'll come to that in a minute. You can tell us all about your stuff. But I just wanted to come back to that one question. It's like you hinted at the fact that it was occupational therapists that could diagnose. Is that right? Or is it a GP or is it a paediatrician? Or who would actually be the person to diagnose that a child had it?
Yeah, no, so it would be an occupational therapist who is sensory integration trained. So that referral might come either through school or through a GP. It takes about the same time for whether it's educational health. And yeah, it would be a matter of seeing the OT and the OT doing maybe 3 or 4 observations or within different environments to assess and to diagnose whether they have a sensory processing difficulties.
Well, I think we're drawing to the end now, Becky, but I just wondered if there is anything else you'd like to say to parents listening, anything you think we've missed that they really should know if they're worried about their child having SPD.
The most important thing is that for parents not to panic and not to stress. There's lots of things out there where we can support young people to be able to cope for themselves. And I know that it can be difficult when become teenagers for various reasons, but the most important thing is that there is information out there. So if you feel like your child really needs some extra support, then just talk to someone. So either go online and have a search for sensory processing difficulties, maybe have a read online, or go straight to the teacher or to your child themselves and have that conversation between them. The best way that we can understand someone's sensory needs is directly from them, which is why all of my work is based on people with sensory processing disorder, because I can't explain it because my sensory processing is very different.
Yeah.
Don't panic. There's lots of amazing resources out there. And most of the time, just try some fidgets. So maybe go to, there's lots of, like Tiger's an amazing shop. Go to a shop, there's lots of affordable things that, even if it's just a pen that has some dials on it that you can turn around, anything like that
So you go for a fidget shop.
Yeah, definitely. I think try a fidget first, and then see what else. If it's visual, then you can try hats. They're quite kind
hats.
Of discreet. So just a hat with a little, like your normal summer peaked hat, reduces overhead lighting really good, or sunglasses.
Yeah.
But some people prefer not to wear sunglasses inside.
Yeah.
And then headphones or wax or something for their ears. To reduce sounds.
Fantastic. Well, it's been really informative and I've learnt a huge amount today, and I'm sure the parents listening have as well. Where do people need to go to find out more about you and your work, Becky?
So my website, sensoryspectacle.co.uk, has got lots of information about what we do, how you can contact us and various things like that, where we've been and where we're going to and things.
So that's all your installations and everything, like where you can actually come and have those experiences as well.
Yeah, all of our workshop and installation information's on our website. So yeah, head straight there for all of that. I'm on all social media. I guess the main one for parents is probably Facebook. Lots of conversations going on there about sensory processing and supporting needs.
How do they find you on Facebook?
Sensory Spectacle.
Okay, so just search for that in Facebook.
Yes.
And
yes.
I will link to all of those, your website, Facebook, and your Twitter and Instagram in the show notes.
Super.
So people can come and have a look at those if they're interested in finding out more.
Great.
Well, thank you so much, Becky. It really has been very insightful. So thank you for sharing all your wisdom with us. And I'm sure some parents will find it very, very useful in kind of learning to understand their children better and finding out more resources for where they can go.
Yeah, I hope so.
Thank you very much, Becky. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to today's show. I really hope you found it interesting and insightful. I certainly learnt a huge amount from Becky, and I wish I'd known about all this stuff while I was still working in the classroom. I do have a few related podcasts, which if you found this episode particularly helpful, you might want to look up and listen to. So firstly, there's episode 25, which is called Everything You Need to Know to Support Your Child with Attention Deficit Disorder, and that one's with Solly Lazarus. Then there's episode 18, Supporting a Child with Asperger's Syndrome, which is with Zoe Short. Then there's episode 15, How to Use the Senses for Deeper Learning and Better Memory, with Joanna Grace. And finally, episode number 9, which is Overcoming Barriers to Learning with Sheila Mulvenny. So if you want to take your knowledge about this topic any further, I suggest you start with those. So all it remains for me to say today is thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and goodbye.